Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test.
Oh, newspaper man meets such interesting people.
Yeah. All right. From the campus of the University of Albany in upstate New York, this is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with you before a live audience of students with Professor Rosemary Armeo, some of whose students are here with us today.
They are. They're going to make me proud.
Absolutely. Investigative journalist and now journalism professor here at UAlbany. And Dr. Alan Shartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio and professor emeritus of communication at this place, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, I remember it.
A man of distinguished and vast capacity. So we're happy to be before this group of students on the UAlbany campus, and it is appropriate, I think, for us to start with just a little bit of conversation about student media, which is a topic that we don't often address.
No.
But this comes about because of an incident just a little further upstate from us at another State University of New York campus, SUNY Plattsburgh, where the college paper has just published a cartoon that is quite remarkably racist, showing a blackface character with bulging eyes and exaggerated white mouth walking through a decrepit neighborhood. And it makes you wonder, what was anybody thinking, right? That in 2015, you would see this kind of a caricature on the front of a campus newspaper. So it raises the question, what do you do when that kind of a thing happens? And what kind of responsibility might, let's say, professors, the journalism faculty have in that sort of a situation?
Yeah, I'd like to think that could never happen at the Albany Student Press.
Right.
But in point of fact, for the same reason that it did at Plattsburgh, it could happen here. The student newspapers are independent. They are run separately from and away from the journalism department. That's a product of the 60s when newspapers felt constrained, the student newspapers felt constrained in writing about war protests. Plattsburgh does have a faculty advisor, which we do not here.
Because it's a practicum, right?
Because it's a practicum. You actually get some credit. At UAlbany, you don't really get credit. It's akin to a club. So could it happen here? Absolutely. And what were the students thinking? They weren't thinking at all. There's something about having historical and generational knowledge. We have it. We would automatically not have run that. We would not even have considered it. And these students looked at it, and they did not see anything objectionable about it. It was no evil intent. There was no idea that they wanted to annoy black people or insult anyone. They were shocked to hear it. There was no conception that a black face in a cartoon would bother anybody.
Of course, Rosemary, we see examples in other countries where somebody who's Muslim is depicted in such a way, and the press in the United States yells, let's be fair, you know, it's terrible to tell them what they can't do. That's just censorship.
But so should there be, for an ostensibly independent campus newspaper, should there be some sort of review? Right now, of course, the university administration is having to answer for this. What's wrong
exactly
with your students that you're allowing them to publish racist stuff on the front page of the paper?
You know, they're in college. They're learning it. So they are going to make mistakes. I want my students to try lots of different things, to stretch, to take chances, to do crazy things, because then I'm in a position to make it a teachable moment to say this is good because, or it's bad, it doesn't work for the following reasons. And that's what that university is doing now. They're apologizing. We're sorry. They don't get it. We're going to be talking about this. And that's just the way it should be. I would like more freedom for student journalists. At the high school level, let's talk about that, where they really are constrained, as well as at the college level.
Well, you know, Rosemary, back when I taught at New Paltz for a long, long time, there was a college president who permitted a conference on sex. It was a sex conference. And I think it was the first presentation at a college campus, or right up there, of the Vagina Monologues. And then there was hell to pay.
From who?
What? They were talking about sex on a college campus? I'm stunned.
And they, the college president soon thereafter, his contract was not renewed.
Hmm.
And this was the Pataki administration, I believe.
You know, it's a difficult situation because in journalism, one of our charges is sometimes to make people a little uncomfortable by raising questions that are not otherwise raised. On university campuses nowadays, there is a significant pushback against some difficult questions being raised. There is a great deal of concern about so-called microaggressions or trigger points. That is, if you're in an English class reading a passage about rape, you're supposed to, isn't this correct now, signal that this is going to happen so that rape survivors, people mm-hmm. who have had some experience in sexual assault, may opt out of that. I have a little trouble with that.
I have a lot of trouble with university administrators being in charge of censorship at all. Sorry to be saying this on my own campus. But it's a very small step from going, no students, we don't put blackface in the paper, to saying, no, we don't really want to explore how the provost was spending money. No, we don't really want a story that has, even though it's all public records and we reject it when you tried to get them, we don't want you running that story. It's a really, really close step. It's not something that a journalism program should be helping in any way. Do you think? I understand we have to teach taste and verification and all the things that a professional journalist has to know. But as far as going after the news, go after the news on your campus, too. Mm-hmm.
However uncomfortable it may make people, right?
Right. But I can sit here and agree with you, and I do agree with you, Rosemary and Rex.
That's unusual.
Yeah, I don't always agree with you. But on the other hand, I'm just glad I'm not the college president.
Having to deal with it, right?
Has to deal
yes,
with
having
them.
To talk to about the well. If hopefully it's a learning moment, and there will be something coming out.
We've had incidences of this across the whole country too.
Sure.
Similar, there's a professor at Ohio University who brought in for a class on public records the arrest report for a young woman, student at the school, who had been very loud and just a jerk when the police were trying to arrest her. There's now a charge against her of resisting arrest. And he used that as an example in his class for what's in a public record. It's also an object lesson in how you should behave if you don't want to be found out. And he was called in on that this was insensitive to a student who wasn't in the class, but some of her friends were, as I understand it.
Well,
and that became, this was for a public record, a record that any citizen, well, of the world, yeah, you don't even have to be an American to get our records.
Now, the reason this is so important, I think, is that the very students who are now in danger or who are being yelled at are going to have to go on to careers in journalism, right? And they are going to have to put up with certain things that are not all that unusual. Rex and I have a common friend who published
an uncommon friend. Yeah. Our friends are all uncommon.
Yeah, who published a newspaper. Okay, it's Ira Fussfeld.
Okay.
Down in the Hudson Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And he's run stories which has cost major advertising at a time from automobile dealers, for example, at a time when you really can't afford to lose any advertising. The newspaper business is in such bad shape. So what kind of guts are you going to have? Are you going to risk your job by writing an article or not?
Mm-hmm. And that's a grandiose case. I've had students go to Albany County Courthouse and try to get records for a court case, totally, absolutely open, nothing about them is closed, and they'll be told by a clerk who affects an attitude saying, no, you can't have that, that's a murder case, we don't show them. Which, of course, is ridiculous to anybody who's actually covered courts. Those are the cases you most want. And students have to learn to push back against that, to say,
yes,
no, really, here's the law, and I really would like to see it, or your supervisor to explain why not. So, yeah, it's important, even on a college campus, even when they're going to make mistakes, to support and to teach.
Okay. We ought to talk about a different way to reach young people with information. A campus newspaper is one way, but of course we know that print is a diminishing breed and that a lot of people get most of their information nowadays from social media, from Facebook, from Twitter, Snapchat, from Instagram, various places where I have a daughter who's a college sophomore who gets, I think Instagram is perhaps her major source of information, well, of her friends. But she does read most significant news stories via Facebook, because all of the major media are delivering information via Facebook. About 12% of the traffic on TimesUnion.com, the website that my company presents, about 12% comes from social media linkage. So we work very hard to push our information out on social media. So here is the question for those of you who may not have done your homework. What big medium had the most interactions on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, in the last quarter of the year, in July through September?
What medium?
Yeah, what medium do you think was number one?
New York Times.
New York Times, huh? What do you think, Alan?
I think public radio.
Sorry, didn't mean to laugh. No, the answer is going to surprise everybody. The answer is National Geographic. Isn't that amazing? National Geographic has a remarkable social media presence. National Geographic was bigger than, and way ahead of those that you named, are also Fox News, the Bleacher Report, which is an ESPN, right? Even WWE, formerly known as the World Wrestling Federation, has a higher score than the New York Times. But National Geographic had 482 million actions on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Well, I don't know, but it's
we get it in the house. It's quite boring.
Is that right?
Oh, sure. Hmm. So I don't know. I know why we used to buy it when we were kids.
Do you mean National Geographic is quite boring?
Yes.
Or the World Wrestling Federation is quite boring?
You get National Geographic. But yeah. We used to buy it because you could see ladies without any clothing on. And so that was special.
That goes back to last week's show when we talked about the change in Playboy.
He always talks about women with no clothes on.
Yeah, I know. It's an important topic. You know, I think the reason that they had such a high rating is because of the pictures, because people go through a photo gallery and they'll click on each one.
Photo galleries, and they have the best interactive maps everywhere, including in space and underwater. It's they have worked to develop material on the internet that others have not. And I guess that's what I was aiming for with the New York Times, but they're way far behind.
Way far behind, yeah.
That's why Prince dying. Now, we just have to move faster.
Yeah. But we also know that Rupert Murdoch, right, has now bought National Geographic.
This is correct. So he's going to be right up there along with his Fox News and National Geographic and everything else.
He knows where the power is.
He does. Yeah, quite amazing.
Well, it was interesting in the debates last night, the Republican debates, which
as
were
we speak,
on CNBC, last night as we speak. CNBC was broadcasting it. That was a TV. That's a cable television station. And across the bottom, they were running various Twitter tweets were showing. And they were pretty great because most of the tweets were about how terrible CNBC was doing with the debates. Like, do you believe these guys? And they're running them along the bottom.
Do you think that was organized? Don't you think that that's a great effort by the campaigns to discredit the mass media?
Well, from the moment they got on, Rex, they were all unified in only one thing, all these Republican candidates, and that is how bad CNBC was. So you wonder what was up. Obviously,
well, I agree with them on CNBC. They were bad. That medium was bad. But the attacks by the Republican candidates were against the media in general.
So why do you think they were bad?
Why do I think CNBC was?
Yeah.
Their questions were not formulated in an authoritative way. They did not have control over the candidates. I mean, they would begin speaking and immediately say, "Governor, governor, governor, governor." The person would just keep talking, the candidate. But you had this person, the moderator, not in control at all, just yelling at them.
And some of the questions were rather silly, right?
Silly and stilted.
Unlike, I think, most of the reviews from the first three debates now, two Republican and one Democratic, and I think most of the reviews of how the moderators have handled things have been favorable, that they've been sensible, aggressive. I was not that thrilled about the Fox handling of the first Republican debate myself. I thought it was too much like a sports event with the commentators playing along. Hey, isn't it great? They were smiling and laughing at the candidates' answers. It's just all in the family.
But this was some of that, but also with poorly prepared questions. Becky Quick at one point asked a question of Trump, and he goes, "That's completely wrong." And she goes, "Oh, where did I read that?" She actually read it on his website. She had caught him, if she had been prepared, in a bald-faced lie. But all she could say was, "Now, where did I read that?" It was just a very, very poor performance by the media. It did not help, and it made the criticism of the candidate against all media seem valid.
Memo to future debate moderators, do your homework, you know, don't fail to be sure that you know exactly where your material comes from that you're going to cite, and don't fail to be aggressive, because politicians are very experienced at trying to put down reporters.
Well, but it hasn't helped Jeb Bush deal with the media. He's terrible.
Not despite his experience?
He just is insipid. Don't you think that politicians, as well as newspaper people, you know,
well, conservatives have long made hay by attacking the media, and you saw Marco Rubio do that last night.
Sure.
Definitely Ted Cruz. Wow, that was awesome. Even Huckabee went after, and he's supposed to be the nice one. So they all went after the media. But Jeb's problem is he just looks annoyed. I mean, you just put a camera at him, and he looks persnickety and kind of, oh, God, the stupid media. And it comes across as you're talking to me that way. You're talking to me, the person who is looking at the media.
Do you object to the second day stories, actually their first day stories, the analytical stories that point out who won and who lost? Marco Rubio won the debate. Trump and Carson, not so much. And some guys are fading. What do you think about the analysis?
Well, it's interesting that you say that, Rex, because we talked about it earlier on the roundtable on WAMC, which is that the analysts all said who won and lost.
Mm-hmm.
Rubio won, Cruz won, Jeb Bush lost. Okay,
right.
But the poll that came out, the quick and dirty poll, showed Trump won by a lot.
No kidding.
Yeah. So like 46%. So
he got a big boost, according to the polls, right?
So once again, the punditry, the political pundit class, is not good at analyzing the public response.
Well, my problem with the political pundits is inevitably they work for somebody. And here's where Rosemary and I will probably have a major fight.
Aren't you a political pundit? Excuse me. Who do you work for?
No. I work for public radio, which is clear, down the middle, and fair.
Okay.
What happens is the people who sign the paychecks of the pundits can almost always be predicted to be calling the shots. Not that they go to them and say, you have to do it this way. It's that the guy who's getting the paycheck knows full well what he has to do. Or the woman, I might say.
We used to rely for a reaction to debates and politics like this on interviews after the show or the correspondents, and they gave their opinion and whatever biases they had. So I think it's pretty amazing now that you can go on Facebook, you can go on Twitter, and those are media that have metrics. They can actually say, Twitter can tell
Absolutely.
You what percent mentions so-and-so, and you know, and they can measure positive or negative. It's more effective than polling. And I do like to hear reactions. I like to see if it measures against what I thought. You know, how can anybody think that? Isn't that what we've been saying most of today? But there are many people who say that the media shouldn't be writing about this at all, that we're not paying attention to the issues, we're not paying attention to what people care for, we're just paying attention to the horse race. So what do you think of that? I think the horse race is interesting.
The horse race is part of setting the stage for people. If you don't cover the horse race at all, if you don't let people know who's rising and who is not, you're not helping them to understand the winnowing of the field. So that is an important part of it. I think it is overdone by the American media. But the problem always comes down to that old adage, you can lead a horse to water but can't make him drink. If you focus your coverage entirely on the issues that are important to the country, you will not have any readers. You'll not have any viewers on television or listeners on the radio, because Americans wish to have some entertainment value from their media, and that's what the horse race is about.
There's just so much you can read on income inequality, in other words.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's why Trump is leading in the polls, in my opinion, because he's a great entertainer. You know, young Bush, Jeb Bush, not so much.
Yeah, not so much. Interesting. All right, we want to turn to an interesting criticism that has arisen over the past week about one of Alan's favorite targets, the New York Times. To be fair, I know that, Alan, you always say also, no, it's a wonderful newspaper.
It is. It's the best newspaper in the world, I think. And I read it 3 or 4 times every night when I wake up with some kind of paranoid fantasy.
Trips back to sleep. So one of the questions is, why did the Times not handle, in a big way, a story that some people thought was very big? There's a national security news site called The Intercept. The Intercept is known basically for being something like the home of Snowden. It is The Intercept that has published a lot of material that came out of the Pentagon Papers. It is an independent website. It's founded by Glenn Greenwald, who was the first person who published the classified information, or wrote the classified information that Snowden revealed. The Intercept had a major story a couple of weeks ago about the use of drones, the inner workings of the American drone program, describing the kill chain that points out that perhaps 90% of the individuals killed in one five-month period during operations in Afghanistan were civilians, unintended targets. It was, by some measures, important content that did not get a lot of attention in the mainstream media. It got a lot of attention in The Intercept. Notably, it was a couple of paragraphs at the bottom of a New York Times story, leading you to wonder, what's going on here?
I spoke to one of the reporters on that Intercept story.
Oh, really?
She's a former New York Times reporter. And she said, I love that column. talking about
Margaret Sullivan, the public editor of the Times, criticized this.
Who held the paper to account saying we owe them more. It's a hugely important story. And it didn't get play in the Times, but I think I disagree a little that it hasn't gotten attention in the press. I may assign it to students. It's a really remarkable story looking at this military program that has gotten no attention whatever. It's the killing machine of choice of our president, and it isn't very effective. This is the first time we've looked at it. So, The Intercept itself, yeah, it's like a repository of all those papers. We still don't know how many there are that Snowden has carried away, and we're going to see, I think, a number of major stories coming out of Intercept from
that. But it's Rex who raised the question as to why the Times didn't do the story justice.
I think there's one answer that could be this, that the Times has done its own reporting previously on drones. And they have done a big story in April, and in 2012 they revealed, it was the Times that first revealed that Obama had a kill list that he used to use the drone program. So to a certain extent you'd say, well, been there, done that. That is a defense that it's a defense that we often hear in the newsroom when an editor goes to a reporter and says, hey, why didn't we have this story on your beat that the other paper across town had? Ah, we've had that. There's nothing to that. And that is the typical response when you feel as though you might have been beat. We already had that. But there is something to be said for the fact that readers will often say, why didn't you have this story when, in fact, we might have had something just about like that a month ago or 6 months ago? And people don't focus it that way. If you don't have the story today, if I didn't see the story, you're not covering the story.
Which leads me to ask the following question. Have things really changed? So, for example, do we now see newspapers quoting other newspapers, which we would not have seen in the old days?
Yes.
I think it's beginning to happen.
Absolutely. And when I began, that was anathema. You would never even print any of the information, or certainly not the other paper reported the following. You just wouldn't see that. Now, in investigative reporting, that's widely done.
And there's actually an ethical standard that is important for journalists to think about, and that is linking. Because so much of journalism is now delivered digitally, it is not only ethically appropriate for you to cite your source, to say, as first reported in the New York Daily News, but it's also in your story important to attach, to have a hot link so that the person reading that story can click, go to that source, or to go to the original document. We are transforming our night copy desk at the Times Union. This is a little work in progress right now. People who are experienced mostly at doing the final edit on stories and writing headlines, we're trying to set it up so that for the last hour that they work at night, some of these people, they're going to be adding hot links to stories. They're going to be augmenting reporting that we have done so that we can give original source material, stories from which we have drawn, and linked stories in other media so that people who are reading Times Union content can get more information on the stuff that we're reporting. It's just a good ethical journalism.
Do you think you'll see the day that the New York Post and the Daily News do that with each other?
No.
No.
It seems unlikely.
Speaking of the ethics of this, there's a school of thought that if you steal the content of another story, if the Times, for example, said Intercept ran an interesting story that said, and then you do a summary or a synopsis of it without the link, or even sometimes with the link if your synopsis is very long, they don't go there. So you, in effect, have stolen the click. And that's seen as a new form of plagiarism. Almost.
I love it. Stolen a click.
Stolen click. On that point, we're going to have to stop. Amazingly enough, we're at the end of our half hour. So special thanks, of course, to our producer, David Gustina, as always, our engineer today here, Kristen Gilbert, and to the students of Professors Thomas Bass and Ennis Golden and Rosemary Armeo. Thank you all for being here with us. Professor Armeo, thank you for your presence.
Come
Professor
again.
Shartok, I'm Rex Smith from the Times Union. Thank you all for joining us this week on The Media Project.
They claim to represent the common people. Funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.